Group meeting, Sunday, 22nd June, 1986. Today, let us consider the three main aspects which marked the teaching in the old days and the mode of teaching. The relationship between teacher and pupil was an extremely close and intimate relationship. The pupil was always regarded by the teacher as he regarded his own son or sons, as the case may be. He treated the pupil with the utmost consideration and kindness, never utilized his youth and strength to do jobs for him or anything like that, which does happen nowadays in schools, for instance, and so forth. It was a relationship in which the teacher, because he was a true teacher, was able to see exactly what the pupil was like, what his nature was, what were his problems which may have been hidden from the pupil himself. And the teacher knew how to deal with these problems. But in the beginning, this was all in the conditioned sphere. And the teacher had to try and help the pupil to understand that conditioning. The teacher was able to help the pupil to understand his own conditioning. And the first rule, as far as the development of the spiritual life was concerned, was to learn to listen. It was called Shravana. Shravana, derived from shru, meaning to hear. He was taught to listen all the time, carefully. You know how in the school of Pythagoras, the first 2 years were spent by the pupils in complete silence, apart, I suppose, from saying, please pass the salt when necessary, and so forth. But apart from that, they kept absolutely silent. They trained themselves to listen, and only to listen. And this listening entails not merely holding one's own tongue, but holding the tongue of the brain too. That is an aspect which is not given out in the accounts of the Pythagorean school, as far as I am aware. But this is the more important part of learning to listen, to pay complete attention to what is being said or expounded. Attention so complete that the brain doesn't talk back at what is being said. This is very important. You all know from your own experience that when somebody is talking, one's own brain is chattering back at him. Oh, that's a fine point. Oh, that's nonsense. No, I don't agree with that. How could that possibly be the case? That's just what I want and I need. How do I know if that is just what I really need? It may be a want, but a want is utterly different from a need. Especially a need where the spiritual development of the person is concerned and the living of the religious life is concerned. So, the pupil was taught to listen completely. This was the first important step towards enabling him to realize the significance of silence. Because, as I have written in Thor, for instance, when I am silent, the king speaks. Who is the king? Transcendence itself. And that great primordial creative energy releases its message to me if I am really silent. Otherwise it doesn't. Otherwise what I hear is really my own conditioned self talking back at me. This was the first aspect of the learning by the pupil, to listen so completely that he would be quiet within his own brain. In that quietness, he could really understand the inner significance of what was being told him and of the way in which he was instructed. This was Shravana. Then came the other aspect, which is called Manana. This means to reflect upon. Now, for the pupil to reflect upon what he had heard involves himself musing. And of course all musing, all thinking is necessarily a silent, it's an inaudible talking all the time. And this time, his talking would reveal to himself all that was all that filled up his own psyche, his conditioning in short. That would express itself through that reflecting process. There would come the point when that would quieten down. And when that quietened down, the teacher would ask him various questions to find out just how far he had really understood and really seen himself as he actually is at the moment. It was only after that process, and of course it took quite a long time, there came what the third aspect, Nididhyasana. Nididhyasana is meditating. By this time, the pupil had gone far enough in realizing quietude, tranquility within his own mind, so that he could meditate with profit, meditate in the right way. Now this raises up a tremendous question. We today think of meditation, or rather practice meditation, as a verbal ritual. It is a silent verbal ritual after all. We are told to send out good thoughts to others, and may everybody in the East be happy and in the West and so forth. And everybody in the East is in terrible turmoil, and everybody in the West is in a terrible state of murder and rape and robbery and God knows what not. I don't think God knows, otherwise it's topic probably. But there we are, you see. So, meditation in the real sense means entering the meditative state. It is not a state of mere musing, which is talking, silent talking. It is a state where the psyche has already been pretty purified and there is complete tranquility of mind. It is a state when the significance of the void as the source of the plenitude is beginning to be realized. There is no talking or thinking going on in the ordinary sense. It is the first touch of the transcendent state. There is complete silence where the brain is concerned. It doesn't react, because the reaction of the brain, reaction, is due to the conditioning of the brain throughout one's life. When there's no reaction from the brain and it is quiet, then the awareness, the consciousness of transcendence itself begins to grow. And the brain is so influenced that it can conceive truly. Ordinarily, our conceptions are not truth at all. One of the finest presentations of that is in the Mahayana Diamond Sutra. Our conceptions are no conceptions. The true conceiving starts in the silence. That is why the silence is of such fundamental importance. So in that silence, the brain then is able to produce conceptions which do not mislead the person as regards truth. The truth is unspeakable, really. It cannot be conveyed in any sort of formulation. But you can become aware of it. And the conceptions which arise when one does enter the meditative state are conceptions which are suggestive of the transcendent reality. Now the context, as you all know by now, the context of the transcendent reality is the infinite and the eternal. Whereas all our talking, all our thinking, and all that we do is in the context of the finite and the temporal, which is the mortal. This is the unreal in Upanishadic terms. You know that famous prayer which you find in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Asato ma sadgamaya. Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma mam angrutam gamaya. From the unreal, lead me to the real. From darkness, lead me to light. From death, release me into immortality. The experiencing of immortality comes when one is silent, absolutely silent and quiet. The psyche is void. It's empty of all conditioning, of all those states thoughts, feelings and so forth, which are like so many blocks which shut out the light of transcendence. The light of transcendence is indescribable. It is not like an electric light or a candle light or anything. It is something utterly different. It is a mode of awareness which negates everything that we are aware of in our ordinary everyday life in terms of the finite and the temporal. It is a mode of awareness which is of the nature of immortality. Now, in the context of the infinite and the eternal, everything happens simultaneously and it never stops. The creative process, the act of creation, the primal act, which is the transcendent karma, which ultimately brings forth the universe as such, that just goes on continuously. It never stops. It is infinite, not limited. And it is eternal, it is not temporal, and it is not restricted to timelessness as we can experience timelessness. This is where I do feel that an error has been made throughout the ages, even by the greatest of mystics. They have identified timelessness with eternity. Timelessness is an experience you or I can have, which starts at a particular moment in time, here and now, whilst the body is alive. This is the important point. And it can last an hour, many hours, it can last a few days, but not more than 7 days. You know, in the Majjhima Nikaya, for instance, I think it's the 6th or 7th discourse, you will find the Buddha talking to some Jains, and he says that he can stay in this condition for 7 days and 7 nights. But think carefully. The human body needs to sleep, it needs to eat, to assimilate, to eliminate, and so forth. And these natural functions cannot be denied too long. So the person must wake up out of that experience of timelessness. The timelessness is the precursor, the experience of timelessness is the precursor of the actual clear consciousness of eternity. But whilst one is alive, no one can have the clear consciousness of eternity for all his lifetime. Can't do it. Because the body's needs demand that there must be a stop to the experience of timelessness. So now, this meditation, which is Nididhyasana, in the early stages is similar to the meditation which is carried out by people who follow various this, that or the other system of meditation. But we must wake up to the fact that it is only a system, you see. It is something which has to be transcended. You put it aside afterwards, ultimately. Now, in connection with yoga, and yoga has so much to do with meditation and so forth, there are various kinds of yoga. As you know, there's Hatha Yoga, there's Japa Yoga, there is Laya Yoga, there is Mantra Yoga. Now, Mantra Yoga is the spoken word, but that spoken word must have the power behind it of a mind which has developed so far that it can produce a psycho-spiritual atmosphere which enables you to experience something at least of the truly transcendent state. Now this japa yoga, this mantra yoga, this is a book of the Yoga Upanishads, which are in existence. Now, these Upanishads come under certain categories, as we may say. And there is always a preliminary paragraph which you repeat, like a preliminary prayer to put you into the right mood and to invoke the right sort of response from transcendent energies and so forth. That is the purpose of that. It's only a short prayer. One of them is, I think I've repeated this some years ago to you, that is full. This is full. If fullness is abstracted from fullness, fullness remains. Now you see, that is utterly nonsensical from the ordinary everyday standpoint. Because if something is full and you abstract the fullness, how can fullness remain? Obviously not. But in the context of eternity and infinity, it is true. Don't rack your brains when you go home and say, what on earth does that mean? The brain will never grasp it. You will only become aware of it if and when somehow, because you are you, transcendence will touch you. And then you will know that that is so. You see, everything happened, all the contraries happened simultaneously in the transcendent context. They happen simultaneously. For example, where eternity is concerned, past, present and future are there simultaneously. And the movement of development, spiritual development, which we think of as beginning in the past and then moving into the future, also does the reverse trick of starting from the future into the present and going back to the past. A marvelous chaos, isn't it? But it is out of chaos that cosmos emerges. And cosmos, the word means order, justice, truth, the divine law. That's what cosmos means. Zarathustra called it Asha. The Rigvedic people called it Ritha, and so forth. The ordinances of God, as the theistic religions would put it, and so forth. So now, this business of the mantra, you have this mantra yoga where you are asked to repeat a particular word. Get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and spend 3 hours or so before breakfast repeating a particular word. Over and over again. Now, in India, for instance, they use the name of Ram. Rama is a name for God. You see, the historical Rama was deified because he was the absolutely just, pure king. So, Ram, 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 they go on muttering away, you see. They might as well say Coca-Cola, Coca-Cola to get any result out of it. or we might as well say, I'm an idiot, I'm an idiot, which is very true, and so on. Now, look at what the Yoga Tattva Upanishad says about this. About this mantra yoga, the repetition of a word. You see, it's a form of self-hypnosis. You anesthetize yourself. You drug yourself with it. That is the drawback. And the writer of the Upanishad says, I shall presently relate the description in an abbreviated form of these. O Brahman, listen to them. He who utters the mantras made up of the matrikas, the letters of the alphabet, for 12 years shall attain gradually knowledge associated with special powers. But he ends up by saying, the practitioner of an inferior type, endowed with small intelligence, will have recourse to yoga of this variety. An inferior type of practitioner will have recourse, of small intelligence, will have recourse to yoga of this variety. That's what is said in the Yoga Tattva Upanishad. So now, back we go to Nididhyasana. The entering into the meditative state in which one can truly meditate upon what are called the great sayings, the Mahavakyas. Vakya is saying, Maha is great. The Mahavakyas. Tat Svam Asi. That thou art. Tad Asmi. That am I. Or Aham Brahmasmi. I am Brahman. The absolute all. Now, if anybody today in the modern world were to say, I am God, or I am the absolute all, people might feel, poor chap, shouldn't he be in a mental home? That is what they would say, and quite naturally. But it is a fact for the person who is able to enter the truly meditative state, the transcendent state, where all this which belongs to the finite and temporal and is mortal is completely negated in consciousness, nowhere else. Because all the great teachers, every single one of them, suffered illness and died physically. There was no getting away from that fact. So whatever we do, here and now, we can never realize immortality in the sense of the immortality of the manifestation of a human being. But in consciousness, whilst one is alive, it is possible to reach that state of silence, that state of stillness, which enables your consciousness to open up to that light. When the Buddha frequently uses that phrase, in clear consciousness, he enters upon the infinity of akasha, the infinity of consciousness, the infinity of the no-thing, and then neither consciousness nor unconsciousness, and in finally the complete cessation of everything that belongs to the sphere of mortality. Remember his very first words. Hearken, bhikkhus, after the enlightenment when he goes to them, hearken, bhikkhus, the deathless has been found. I expound, I teach the way. If you go along this way, faithfully, earnestly, in no long time you will yourselves realize this and will be able to abide in it. So, the importance of silence. Now, there's another way to look at the to appreciate the importance of silence. All the languages of the world, all the words of every language in the world, refer to some object or person, some event, some condition, or whatever it is. You see? But every one of these things belong to the realm of the mortal. They are finite. They come into being. They have their lifespan and they pass away. Something else comes in instead. This is the real clue to the true meaning of rebirth or reincarnation. When I'm thinking a particular thought, or I'm in a particular mood, or whatever it is, I associate myself with it. I am aware that I am thinking this, I am feeling this, etc., etc. It is in this self-association is my living process, my life. When it passes away, I am dead. The self-association has come to an end. So I am dead. And the very next thing, the very next stimulus through via the senses always, well, perhaps not always, but generally, via the senses externally or from memory internally, that stimulus once again produces a beginning, a proceeding, and a dying. And I associate myself with that. So I am born and I die millions of times during the lifetime of this psychophysical organism. I think that is the true meaning of rebirth or reincarnation, or if you like to use the nice big Greek words, transmigration, metempsychosis, metensomatosis, palingenesis. You see, it sounds very learned, but it all means the same blinking thing. So now, the task of the teacher for the pupil is to help him to free himself from his conditioning and realize the unconditioned state. And then, in the unconditioned state, he has become the perfectly enlightened Holy One. Now, the truly great teacher, the truly wise teacher, the perceiving teacher, knows that every single human being is unique. There are no two leaves on a tree, no two blades of grass which are absolutely identical. Still more so, no two human beings are absolutely identical. We have a basic identity as far as structure is concerned. Skeleton, flesh, blood, bones, and all the rest of the stuff. You see? That way we are identical, if you like. Even that, my bones are different from yours, and so on and so on, in some way or other. This incalculable variety, which is the manifested universe, just shows the marvel, the wonder of the power of transcendence to produce a variety continuously. So the teacher knows that each person is unique, and he has to discover for the truth for himself. That is to say, he does not discover the truth as an external object. There's nothing external and objective where the truth is concerned. The truth is right here and now, in me, myself. The whole psychophysical organism is the truth. To understand the organism means that you have understood truth in a big way. You know, there is that lovely discourse by the Buddha. Which shows the importance of mindfulness with regard to the body. I can't remember the exact chapter and verse at the moment. But study that discourse carefully, if you can come across it. There he shows things which bear out, at least I think they do, which bear out what I have been saying. So you have to find it out for yourself. That is why self-knowledge is absolutely essential. Way back in the Rig Veda, you have this statement, Atmanam Atmana Pasya, to see the Atma, the Absolute, the Supreme Truth, the ultimate reality, to see the Atma by means of the Atma, that is, within yourself. Because, as I've said so often, we are transcendence embodied. We are Atma or Brahman concretized. That is what we are, actually. So that whether you're a good chap or a very, very bad chap, you still are the transcendent embodied, concretized. But because consciousness developed in us through a long process of evolution, through the animal kingdoms, we can either be sensible enough to work in harmony with that fact or to go against it. And that was the statement in the Rig Veda, Atmanam Atmana Pasya, to see the Atma by means of the Atma. And there is another statement. Anybody remember? Oh yes, it comes right from the time of Thales of Miletus. He was the first person to say, that is to say, where Greek culture is concerned, "Nothi se auton, know thyself." The originator of that is Thales of Miletus. And of course, it became the great guide for the great Greek schools of philosophy. And for them, philosophy meant the wisdom of life, really. To love life, the truth, the actuality. I think we'll have to stop there today. These were the three essential aspects of the teaching by the Brahman teachers of the old days. When I say Brahman teachers, not just belonging to a caste called the Brahman caste. The true Brahman was defined very beautifully in the Vajrasuchi Upanishad. Whatever the caste in which you are born, if you realize Brahman, the supreme reality, and have fulfilled the purpose of your existence, you are a Brahman.